Hello, I'm Preston Schleinkofer. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. What does that mean? In a nutshell, it is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disasters might affect you and your community. This week's episode is with Drew Bumbeck again. He's a favorite of ours, and we're going to be talking about pandemic influenza. Hello, Drew. Welcome back.
Hi, Preston. Thanks for having me.
Yes. We discussed a little bit about this pre-show here, and this is a threat that I think that people gloss over whenever they hear about it. They really can't understand why this would be a big threat in this day and age with all the advancements that we've had in medical technology and stuff. So can you give us an idea of why the average person should pay attention to this threat and why it can get out of hand so quickly?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you've got a great point. You know, we have all this modern medicine, and you know, we can do things now that we couldn't do 50 years ago. We have medicines that can, you know, treat all sorts of ailments that didn't exist 50 years ago. And people think that, you know, a lot of people don't realize there's a distinction between, for example, bacteria and viruses. And so they assume, well, you know, if I get sick, if I get a cold, I can take antibiotics and that'll kill anything off. Well, first of all, a lot of illnesses, particularly influenza and colds, are caused by viruses, which we don't really have drugs that kill viruses. We have some drugs that can affect some viruses, but we don't have a magic bullet like we do for bacteria. And of course, you know, a lot of bacteria are now developing resistance to antibiotics, but that's a whole nother show.
Yeah.
So, and people also don't realize that, you know, even a regular, the seasonal flu epidemic that we get every year, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, it happens in what is our summer months. And in the Northern Hemisphere, it happens in what is our winter months. So, even the epidemic, the seasonal epidemic flu, it kills a lot of people. And most people don't realize that, because for most healthy adults and healthy kids, you know, you get the flu, you get a little sick, and that's about it. You're laid up for a few days. And a lot of folks, you know, get the flu vaccine, even though, you know, efficacy on the flu vaccine varies from year to year. And, you know, you've had some vaccines where, you know, some years where the vaccine was only like about 30% effective. So it's like, well, what's the point? But what happens with a pandemic is you get a novel influenza A strain. And so you get an influenza that has been circulating in birds or in pigs, or circulating and recirculating and reshuffling in birds and pigs, and it makes the jump from animals to humans. It's a zoonotic disease, comes from animals, jumps into humans. Typically, that jump occurs somewhere in mainland China, which is where most new influenzas come out of and where most pandemics originate. And it's because a lot of the wild bird flyways converge over China. Also, there's a lot of agriculture in China, and they bring their animals into the house at night to protect them from the cold and from predators. And so you have pigs and people and live birds in very close association, and the viruses can jump back and forth from one host to another, and they reassort genes. And you get a novel strain that human immune systems have not encountered before, at least, you know, within the last 100, 200, 300 years. So we don't have any natural immunity to this. And so then it will make a jump into humans, and then it will eventually get to sustained human-to-human transmission, and it can really explode. Now, when people think pandemic, when they hear that word, what really comes to their mind is the 1918 quote, Spanish flu, unquote.
Right.
Which killed, you know, which was just, you know, absolutely horrendous. I mean, it infected 500 million people worldwide, which was one third of the world's population at the time. And it killed the people who died. The number is estimated to be between 50 and 100 million people died from this. So, I mean, that was horrendous. And you know, people would, there are tales of people would get on a streetcar and they were fine. And by the time the streetcar got to its destination across town, they were dead. And so, I mean, it burned through the population very quickly. It killed a ton of people. And, you know, that's the archetype pandemic in people's minds. So you talk about, say, other pandemics, like what the 2009 pandemic, and that doesn't look like a pandemic because compared to 1918, because it had 151 to 575,000 deaths in a world that is, you know, exponentially more populous than the 1918 world. So, you know, a huge percentage rate decrease in the number of people infected and the number of people killed. So people are like, well, was that a pandemic or wasn't it?
So what would the definition, how can there be so much ambiguity over whether it was or it wasn't? Is it you got to kill so many people before you can go to the big leagues and be a pandemic? Otherwise, you're just a local strain? What's the criteria?
Well, the criteria is that, and this is why there was some argument over 2009, because 2009 technically met the criteria for a pandemic. The declaration of a pandemic is done by the World Health Organization, and they have a series of phases, pandemic phases, and there's phase 1 through 6. It basically becomes a pandemic when it reaches phase 6. And so you have this novel influenza virus that is circulating in humans. There is sustained human-to-human transmission. And you have to have, to get to be a pandemic, not only do you have to have sustained human-to-human transmission, you have to have what WHO says, this virus has caused sustained community-level outbreaks in human-to-human transmission in two or more countries in one WHO region. And then to actually make the jump to be a pandemic, it has to then cause sustained community outbreaks in at least one other country in another WHO region. So, for example, let's say, and because pandemic is, you know, it's a worldwide threat. So the whole thing is 2009, we had sustained human-to-human transmission in the United States. We had it in Canada. And then, you know, you get it in another region. I forget where the third, I think it was a European country, but you had two different WHO regions where one had at least two countries with sustained transmission of this virus and another region had at least one country. So theoretically, you can have a pandemic declaration if you have sustained human-to-human transmission in, say, China and Vietnam, which is in one region, and in, say, Egypt or, you know, the Congo or Chad or Libya or somewhere else that's in another region, and you might not even have much of an outbreak other places in the world, but you still technically have a pandemic. I'm not saying that WHO is doing this wrong, because I mean, they're addressing it from a worldwide standpoint. But when you start saying pandemic, people start freaking out. And then if it doesn't amount to much, like, for example, 2009, you kind of run the risk, particularly if this happens multiple times, you run the risk of, you know, being the boy that cried wolf.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like the local news or the local weatherman. You know, oh, we're going to have a devastating snowstorm, and then, you know, it's bright and sunny and the birds are chirping.
Yeah, exactly. So, and so they have tried to tweak the definition. But again, it's because they're coming, you know, they're essentially coming up with a worldwide definition. There's only so much they can do. So, right. You know, it's, and I think part of it is also really has to do with messaging during the crisis, because crisis communication and communicating that, you know, maybe technically this meets the definition of a pandemic. However, it's not going to be incredibly bad or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. That might help them. And that's something I think that WHO is actually working on. But, you know, and something to remember is, on average, now this is a rule of thumb that, you know, sometimes holds true, sometimes doesn't. But on average, we have 3 pandemics per century. Mm. So if you look at the 20th century, obviously we had the big one in 1918.
Right.
And that was, of course, the worst of our pandemic. But then we had a 1957 and a 1968 pandemic, which, you know, 57 was about 1.1 million deaths. 68 was, I think, about 1 million deaths worldwide, you know, which, again, it's a far cry from 1918. And then we had the fizzled 1976 pandemic, which was a swine flu pandemic that started, we thought we were going to have a pandemic, and then it just kind of burnt out. And that didn't even approach the 2009 pandemic. So, but yeah, we have, however, you did mention medical progress. We've made a lot of progress, and there are some things that we can do better now than in 1918. I mean, obviously, we are much more conversant with germ theory and where the origin of infectious diseases, how to prevent the spread, you know, the importance of covering one's cough, hand washing, et cetera. And also our supportive care is a whole hell of a lot better than in 1918. You know, we can start IVs, we can intubate people and breathe for them. We can give them medicines to counteract some of the things that go on in an influenza pandemic or an influenza outbreak. Although, again, we are also seeing strains of influenza that are resistant to they're developing resistance to the antiviral drugs that we use against them, particularly Tamiflu.
So these influenzas are mainly affect the lungs. So they're an issue that we have with cold and congestion in our lungs, and it just gets really bad with high fevers and stuff. Is that what the conditions are?
Kind of. They're essentially they're an upper respiratory infection. So primarily, you know, you get the runny nose, you get a cough, you get a sore throat. It can get into the lungs, and it also has some systemic effects. I mean, for example, when you get influenza, and of course, the whole, quote, flu-like symptoms, unquote, is ubiquitous for most viral infections. You get fever, you get chills, you get body aches, but primarily the effects center on the respiratory system. And where you have a problem with any influenza, but particularly pandemic, is they trigger what's known as a cytokine storm. So cytokines are part of the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And they essentially, it's not really, it's somewhat akin to, but not really like, an allergic reaction. Essentially, they cause the immune system to go haywire. And when you get a cytokine storm from an influenza infection, that can lead to damage in the lungs, and that can open the patient who has that up to secondary infections like pneumonia. And that's what they found, for example, with the 1918 flu. A lot of people died from pneumonia, or they died because they had pulmonary edema. They had a huge buildup of fluid in their lungs after their lungs were damaged by the cytokine storm, is what we suspect. And so they would essentially drown to death in their own fluid. And the other thing about pandemics that differs from seasonal influenza is pandemics come in waves. Typically, they have, like the 1918 flu, there were 3 waves, where the first wave was actually in the spring and summer, and that was very unusual because you generally don't get influenza circulating in the hemispheric spring and summer. It usually happens only in the fall and winter. And the first wave was fairly benign. I mean, there were very few people who died during the first wave. The second and third waves was increased mortality over the first, and then the third was the worst, with most of the death within each wave being front-loaded. So you have more deaths at the beginning of the wave, then they taper off towards the end. The other thing is that when you look at seasonal influenza, generally the people who are most susceptible, who get sick more often, who get sicker when they have it, and who are more likely to die from seasonal influenza are the very young, the very old, and those who have some kind of immune compromise. So, you know, babies, young children, toddlers, people in their 70s, 80s, 90s, and then people who have some kind of immunocompromise where they're on an immune suppressant drug because they've had transplants or they have some kind of other condition. Their body is weaker systemically. With influenza, and you really saw this with the 1918 pandemic, but you also see it with other pandemics. With the pandemics, that's not necessarily the demographic that you worry about, particularly 1918. The people who really were hit the hardest were essentially the young, able-bodied people, young adults, people between like 18 and 40 or 50. Well, actually, probably 18 and late 30s because, you know, lifespan was shorter then. But the healthy adults were the majority of the people killed and most susceptible.
Now, these pandemics, they're not, as you said, they're not something that's necessarily homegrown here in the United States. They come from other countries. People bring these diseases with them, or migratory birds can infect some birds that they come across, or what's some of the ways that this can spread? Because, you know, in our day and age, with people taking off in one country and landing in the other halfway across the world in the same day, there's a lot of things that can happen.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And so generally, we suspect, we don't always know, but we suspect that most influenzas originate in the Southeast Asian mainland, okay? And I kind of misspoke earlier when I said China, because it's not just China, because you have it in Vietnam and other places. But essentially, you have a lot of wild bird flyways converge over Southeast Asia. And if you look at the flyways, you see that they kind of spread out and they come back together. But birds from northern Canada can end up associating during migratory season with birds from, say, Southeast Asia when they're up in the Arctic or down in the southern hemisphere or wherever. And so you have all these wild birds, particularly geese and other migratory waterfowl. Ducks,
right.
And geese are two of the big ones. They bring different strains of pandemic or of influenza viruses together, and they kind of reassort and they go back and, you know, and they go over Southeast Asia. And Southeast Asia is a remarkably fertile place for growth of pandemic because generally in most places it's warm, it's damp. There's a whole heck of a lot of place for waterfowl to be. There's a whole lot of interaction between wild birds and wild waterfowl and captive birds and captive waterfowl. And you have a lot of, you know, birds are very important to their economy, to their culture. They eat a lot of birds. They capture birds. They have live bird markets in town. And the unique thing about pandemics is, about influenza is, it really likes birds, it really likes pigs, and it really likes humans. So what do they have a lot of in Southeast Asia?
All three.
Well, they eat a lot of bird meat, They eat a lot of pork, and they have a lot of humans, and they're all in close association. So you can have wild birds that fly over a pig farm, and, you know, they may stop and eat and poop, and, you know, next thing you know, the pigs have picked up an H1N1 or an H5N1 from these birds, and they that strain is now reassorting with H7N9 in the pigs, and then it jumps to the captive waterfowl on that farm, and then it jumps to the humans, and then it goes back into the captive waterfowl, and then the farmer takes these birds to a live bird market in, say, Hong Kong or Shanghai or wherever, and other people get it, and it starts making the jump. And so you have a huge, it's really a great incubator. It's essentially a natural incubator for influenza, and it can move from Southeast Asia one of several ways. It can move kind of like we saw with SARS, the severe acute respiratory syndrome.
Right.
It can move because human to human. You
right.
can get somebody who's sick in Southeast Asia, gets on an airplane. They don't have any visible signs or symptoms. They're in the incubation period where they're sick, but they have no symptoms. And so yet they're still infectious and they're shedding virus potentially. And they travel and nobody says, hey, he's sick. We need to, you know, figure out what's going on. They get to Canada or the US or Mexico. And then, you know, people on the plane have been exposed. People in Canada or the US or Mexico are exposed. And so it can spread that way. It can also spread, as we saw in 2014, 2015, we had the huge outbreak of H5N1 in this country, where it was not a human outbreak. It was among birds, but that came over here on the migratory bird route. It started cropping up where wild birds migrated, and it turned into a horrendous outbreak that really damaged U.S. agriculture. It was the worst animal disease outbreak in the U.S. It did not really make the jump to humans. There were some people who were exposed, might have shown antibodies, but it didn't really take on in humans. But a pandemic can also spread by migratory waterfowl.
Yeah.
But as you said, you know, in this day and age with air travel, you can be anywhere in the globe in 18 hours. And that's a great way to spread disease.
Yeah. So it looks like, just looking at some of these links that you sent me, 2009 and the 1918, they were both H1N1 virus, which a lot of people should recognize that name, H1N1. That's the bird flu virus, right? Is that the one?
Well, H1N1, they call a, quote, swine flu. But
okay.
So H1N1, now, the 1918 and the 2009 pandemic strains, even though they were both H1N1, they're also two different viruses.
Okay.
They're related, but they're different. So they classify influenza viruses by the H, which stands for a hemagglutinin, and the N, which is neuraminidase, which are little chemical things that stick out of the influenza virus. I forget the exact number, but I think there's like 9 H's in there, I think there's 10 or 15 different H subtypes, and then there's a number of N subtypes. But just because an influenza virus has a hemagglutinin 1 and a neuraminidase 5 doesn't necessarily mean that it's the same as another influenza virus from 30 years before, 30 years later, with an H1 and an N5.
Okay.
There are other things that also play into it.
All right. Now, in the last minute that we've got, can you give us some ideas on what to do to prepare ourselves and our immune system, besides the En Garde blend that I started the show off with? Can you give us some ideas on personal protection so we can be prepared in our homes and our neighborhoods?
Absolutely. So the biggest thing is, if you get sick, don't go out, you know, so don't spread it around. Don't go to work when you're sick, because that's just wrong. If you aren't sick, keep your immune system as healthy as you can. You know, take vitamins, exercise, eat well, get plenty of sleep, because when you're sleep deprived or stressed, your immune system functioning is reduced. Drink plenty of fluids, wash your hands religiously. And if you can't wash them, first off, when you wash them, 25 seconds, warm water, and, you know, be really careful about, once you wash your hands, don't touch the sink again. Mm-hmm. You know, use a paper towel to turn off the water. Mm-hmm. Use a paper towel to open the door from the bathroom, and cover your cough. And social distancing is a great thing in disease outbreaks, because these things are airborne, okay? If I have it and I cough, it's going to be in this room that I'm in. Well, if nobody else comes into this room, then nobody else is going to get it.
Okay.
Or if I cough and I get it on my hand and then I touch a phone and then I touch a computer keyboard and I touch a doorknob, well, somebody else who comes behind me and touches that phone or that keyboard or that doorknob, they can get it. Sometimes even up to 4 to 6 hours later, the virus is still alive there. So watch what you touch and disinfect things that you touch. And again, wash your hands or use hand sanitizer. You know, alcohol-based hand sanitizer, at least 62% alcohol.
Yeah.
Because that stuff works well.
Good deal. All right. Well, thanks. We appreciate you being on the show today. And civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_def_radio, where we post information about the many threats we see to our safety and security as a nation. I wish to thank Drew again for being on the show, and I wish to thank you, our friends, who are listening to us every week. I really appreciate you being with us this week. And so please be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.